Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast about the galaxy's greatest comics, usually the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark and I am welcoming back to the book club my running buddy, fellow hot dog runner, Lee Tyler. Lee, welcome back to the book club.
Oh, thank you for having me back. I'm chuffed.
It's very nice. Now, last time we did Robot Wars, we went back to almost the very beginnings of Dread. And I think we were sort of enthusing about Ron Turner artwork, I seem to remember.
That was my Grail page.
Yeah, that's right. I remember it. Now, that Grail page might be quite expensive. We're going to go on to some of the possibly most expensive Grail pages we've ever discussed. But
And rarest.
Yes, this is true. Yes, we'll get to that. Explain to our listeners, what is the book that you've chosen to return to the book club with?
Well, I did decide I wanted to try and do something different. And when I mentioned this to you, you sort of jumped at the chance. It's not really sort of the British ones. It's quite an American comic. American drawings and character in Calvin and Hobbes, the syndicated American strip, started in 1987, I believe. So, yeah, absolutely hilarious. Love it. I'm never far in my house away from a copy. And I thought we'd have a chat about that if we could.
Well, as you said, I bit your hand off for this one, Calvin and Hobbes. So this is by Bill Waterston, Words and Pictures. We are looking at the first collection. Now, the first collection is from 1987. Mine is from Sphere Books. But Calvin and Hobbes, I think, ran from 85 to 95. As you say, it's a newspaper strip. Which was then collected up into 10 sort of yearly collections. We'll perhaps talk about this a little bit at the end, Lee. There's so many different ways of collecting in Calvin and Hobbes. But here we have, we've got the first collection. So, as you know, I'm very excited about this. Now, Robot Wars, this is quite a jump. So tell me, why did you pick Calvin and Hobbes? Was it because you wanted to do something different?
Yes, and also this is another one of those sort of early day things. It was I used to work in the city, so I used to go out lunchtimes and we had lots of newspapers around, so we used to pick up newspapers and put them down in the office and look at the funnies, as they call them in the States. And Calvin and Hobbes was one of those ones that really tickled me right from the get-go. You know, originally I used to like picking it. Then used to go down into the Waterstones shops in Leadenhall Market to try not to do anything at lunchtimes but go to the pub, because that was the default setting for everyone who worked in the city at the time. And just while away an hour looking through. And when these books came out of Calvin and Hobbes, I used to be standing there reading them and eventually parting with my cash.
So the newspapers thing, it was widely syndicated in American newspapers. I said to you before we started recording, I just noticed on the back of my book that it said it featured in the Daily and the Sunday Express. Now, readers might be surprised to learn, I didn't read the Daily and Sunday Express, so I didn't know about that. But you probably saw them at work in those newspapers.
Yeah, I don't remember them being in there for long. I can't remember them being there sort of week in, week out. There was a lot of different sort of comics, a lot of different sort of distractions. You used to pick things up and put them down. But if you were waiting to see the boss or get something signed, that was the most time you used to flick through, you know, the paper sitting on the desk outside of his posh office. You know, you'd dive in. And they're perfect. They're perfect little cheer-me-ups. You know, you pick one up, you read it. You know, this little six-year-old boy, maybe we'll get into that in a minute, but it was fantastic just to sort of enjoy the artwork. And if you look back at the first of this book, you have very early drawings of Calvin and Hobbes. They look slightly like he's just starting to get into his stride.
Yeah, interestingly, Bill Waterston, we'll talk about him in a moment, but he says about those early strips that he thinks they look very crude to him now. And you can see that there is a slight development in the look of particularly Calvin. As it goes on. These trade collections came out, and I remember, I don't know if you remember this, Lee, but certainly in my family, they became a yearly excitement. Like, when was the next one coming out? A friend of mine introduced us to Calvin and Hobbes, and then it became a thing in my family. Like, I think they would come out somewhere near Christmas time. There'd be a new collection.
Oh, like the annual, yeah.
Yeah, like an annual, and it would collect the last year's worth of paper, of strips. And like I say, there's 10 of them in total. And they were just, we couldn't wait, really, for the next one. I know I've told this story on other podcasts, but when the new collection arrived in our house, everybody read it. So I think this is the one comic strip that my wife has read. And my kids used to try and sort of hide the book so they could carry on reading it. Much prized. Sorry, say again.
Who's hid my book?
Exactly, yeah. Who's got it now? Yeah. So in our family, our children started. I'm pretty sure that my son learned to read, and possibly my daughter as well, learned to read by reading Calvin and Hobbes. Anyway, tell us the setup, because you've hinted at it. For anybody who doesn't know, who are Calvin and Hobbes?
Well, Calvin is a little 6-year-old boy who is very lucky boy in my eyes, but he's got himself a tiger friend. Now, we assume, reading this, that he's an imaginary tiger friend. He's, you know, when adults or other third parties in the strip are there, he's a stuffed toy, a little stuffed toy. But when they're not around, he has these amazing adventures and these laughs and freedoms of being able to wander wherever he likes with this imaginary friend of his, we think. Now, it could be a magic thing where, like Toy Story, when everyone's not there, he is actually alive. But for us, the reader, we believe he is probably an imaginary friend, but he's more than that when you actually read all of the strips. He becomes a very, very important character with his own sort of abilities, his own humour, his vanities, and he's like any other cartoon character, always hungry, you know, the Scooby-Doo effect. And they go out, and they're allowed to go out at 6 years of age on their own, you know, a little boy, a truck, a stuffed toy, miles away from where his mum and dad are, which always makes me laugh, to do things. I either sledding down massive precipices on a toboggan with no steering, or in a little red truck through paths. And I just think it's one of those things that takes me back to my youth, thinking, I wish I'd have had those freedoms, because I don't even think I had those freedoms. And we were always the ones going on about how much freedom we did have as kids.
I don't know where he set Calvin and Hobbes, but where he lives, there's sort of like a massive outdoors behind the house, it seems, isn't there? You know, there's woods and hills and a creek. And as you say, they're forever careering down hills, either on a sled or on their red truck.
Or coming off these trucks.
Yes.
Toboggans, you know, and falling to lakes, or just generally, you know, probably using up more plasters than is very healthy.
Yeah. So there's Calvin and Hobbes, as we say, these two wonderful central characters, both of whom are at times hilarious, at times philosophical, at times insightful, at times quite sort of sad and moving, you know. It's not in this first book, but you probably know the one later on where I think Calvin finds
The raccoon.
Yes, yeah. The poor little raccoon that's injured and is probably dying. And I think over the course of several daily strips, the raccoon does pass away. And it becomes this really sort of sad sort of... It's quite moving, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely touching where he just says, you know, that he's gone, he turned up for so little time, and now he's just been taken away from us. I didn't know he was there, and now he's gone.
Yeah.
You know, how fair is that of life, you know? He didn't have a chance. And his mum and dad do what mums and dads all over the world do when you lose a precious pet. They cuddle him and they chat to him, but they can't make sense of it any more than he can. And it is very, very moving. And in lots of stages, he's a very empathetic child in some stages, and then totally psych- psychotic in others.
There's a wonderful moment in that where his mom finds herself talking to Hobbs. And of course, when the mom and dad are around, Hobbs is just a stuffed tiger. And she's talking to this stuffed tiger and she catches herself. And, you know, like, you've got me doing it.
Or when he's missing in the woods at that time and she's, you know, they're trying to find him. Hobbs is, Calvin's been put to bed early. He's lost his toy. And the mum shouts out Hobbs at the top of her voice. And then the dad just points the torch at her and she goes, oops, sorry.
And that is in this first collection, isn't it? When Hobbs goes missing, a big dog knocks Calvin down and takes Hobbs away. It's terrible. So sad. Of course, now we've mentioned mom and dad. There is a supporting cast. And one of the punchlines of Hobbs going missing, of course, is where he ends up. Tell us about some of the other characters in the strip.
Oh, well, yes. His nemesis, Susie Durkins. She's a lovely, lovely, intelligent young lady who he just, at this stage in his life, has made him, you know, he wants nothing to do with. He's a boy, she's a girl. It's like black and white. There's nothing they need together. And but they do seem to live in the same orbit, yin and yang. You know, she's sort of a studious young lady, whereas he does everything he can to put off every bit of homework he ever needs. Homework at 6 years of age. I think this is amazing as well. You know, this is a tough life for this kid. And having to read books and stuff like that. He does everything that he procrastinates. He is a perfect procrastinator. There's nothing that can be done that he can't do later. Where she's the complete opposite, and he's trying to figure her out the same way she's trying to figure him out. She's a lovely, lovely kid, and he's a little rotter to her sometimes.
They're in the same class at school, and they're forever getting paired up on projects. And she's...
I thought the teacher would have sussed that one.
Yes. She's always appealing to the teacher. Can I have another partner, please? And of course, the school teacher is a fun character. Calvin's forever seeing her as some sort of giant alien slime monster.
Oh, some of the poor, you know, what do you want to say? He's pushed her up to about 2 packets of unfiltered a day, you know. She doesn't look like a smoker, but he's got her down as one.
His mum and dad are great. His dad's this great sort of loves going outdoors, doing outdoorsy things and camping, which Calvin hates. His mom is always on the point of exasperation with her son.
Now, a very, very sort of standard. The dad goes out to work in an office and mum is, like, at the moment, she seems to be a house mum. We don't see her doing any other jobs. She's got the female job of making food, and it's a very... It's not an interchangeable modern lifestyle that they seem to be leading. It seems to be a sort of different time where mum did certain jobs and dad did other jobs. I like the dad who can't play. They're not allowed to play. Adults aren't allowed to play. Calvin can go out and play. He does Calvin ball. He's made up his own games and that. But dad has to quantify it by going on a bike or, you know, maybe a run or in the snow. So I like all that. I just think, you know, I think the dad wants to be more like his son, really.
Yes.
He's envious of that. He's got to go to work. He's got to earn money. Whereas his son sometimes even phones him up in some of the other collections and just tells his dad what a lovely day it is. Wouldn't you love to be out here? Well, his dad's sitting in an office, which is one of the cruelest things Calvin could do to his dad.
There's a running repeated gag over the 10 years where Calvin is always bringing opinion poll results to his dad. These opinion polls that he's done himself about how his dad's performing in the polls, which is always badly.
You're doing really well, Dad. Oops, sorry, I've got it upside down.
Yeah.
The graph is upside down.
And I also love, she turns up in this first volume that, of course, when Mom and Dad do get an evening out... we get another character appears.
Well, I think this one affects me more than anything else because as a child, I remember we only had it half a dozen times, but we had a Roslyn.
Right.
I won't actually say her name just for legal reasons, but she was a terrible, terrible babysitter. just a dreadful person. And so, I can sympathise with Calvin. Now, you'd really want to you didn't just want to clean your teeth and have your tea and then go to bed. You'd want to play around and muck around and just generally wait until your parents get home, because you're going to get told off. You might as well get told off for enjoying yourself.
Rosalind the babysitter, who is a takes no nonsense, although she gets lots of nonsense from Calvin and Hobbes, particularly in the later volumes. But she's introduced in this first volume, and she's also his swimming coach as well, I think.
Yeah, I only turned up, I think, once in the whole, all the ones I've read. I can't remember being a swimming coach more than that one sort of group of, what do we call them, skits, panels.
Yeah.
She's... She's obviously worked with children a lot. She just doesn't take any nonsense, and she's not far behind him when he mucks about. She often catches him, and she's fast as well. He sort of tries to run away, and she's always wearing trainers and manages to catch him.
So Bill Waterson does the whole thing. He writes and draws it. We'll start with the writing and the jokes. Although, as we've said, actually later, you know, as it develops, it's not just jokes. There's philosophy, there's tragedy, there's all sorts of stuff in there. But I mean,
environmentalism as well. He's talking about the environment. He's actually very, very, as a young boy in America at that time, he's very aware of sort of. He talks a lot about the ozone layer, which we think we've sorted now. But he talks about sort of development of green spaces, you know, in such a big country. That's, you know, we're a smaller country. We're talking about development of green spaces as well. He's very on the nose with that as well. So he's putting a lot of himself in the character, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Any sort of favourite jokes or setups or scenarios from this first collection?
I do like the monsters under the bed. As I'm in a sister, you know, there's three of us in the house, and one of my sisters was very sort of, she knew there was monsters under the bed and we just weren't looking hard enough. In fact, in some cases, she was so convincing, she convinced me there might be some under mine. But, you know, as a sort of 10-year-old boy, I'm meant to be a bit older than that. But, the monsters under the bed where, you know, if the parents don't check, they're there, or, you know, they start talking at night, waking them up. Kid, do you want a nice shiny toy? And he's like, no, I don't believe you. You're a monster. And then they go, all right, then Hobbs, do you want a nice fresh salmon? How fresh is the salmon? Don't listen to them. It's that sort of, you know, he's woke himself up from a dream, obviously, and now he's convinced something under the bed's trying to get him to go under there with him.
It's one of the sort of running scenarios that Calvin is terrified that there is something, that there are monsters under his bed. And I think actually, if I'm looking in the front of this book, the next collection after this one was called Something Under the Bed is Drooling. And his parents get called up, his parents get attacked. Sometimes he sends Hobbs in there. Sometimes he's, you know, it's great. When there's a line in this one, I think, where he, you know, he says, are there any monsters under the bed? And all these voices come out going, nope, 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 nope. And he said, good, because if there was, I was going to get them with a flamethrower. And Hobbs says to him, do you have a flamethrower? And he says, well, they're lying, so I lie. It's just wonderful.
He's fantastic. He really does sort of, he gives that sort of, I'm going to, he's tough as well, mentally tough. You know, I've got to say, if the monster started talking to me from under the bed, there'd be no way that I wouldn't be in that bedroom ever again at that age. Parents would have had to move.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, it just, presumably imaginary monsters that live under Calvin's bed. But they have voices as well. I love the joke that's in this first volume on page 57, which is the toast gag. For some reason in my family, we've always loved this this particular strip panel, or these four panels, where Calvin and Hobbes are playing with the toaster. And Calvin is showing Hobbes that, you know, you put this piece of bread in and you pop this down, you wait a few minutes, and then this piece of toast pops out. And Hobbes says, where does the bread go? And Calvin says, beats me. Isn't that weird? And we've always loved that joke for some reason. We still make that joke when we put the, you know, press the lever down on the toaster. Any others from this first volume, or any other of his sort of writing or his scenarios that you like?
I also like the fearlessness of Calvin. There's one in there, and I think, I don't know if anyone else is going to have this book, but for you, page 65, where he's just basically going onto the top of the roof with a blanket, and he's going to glide down as gentle as a leaf by making a sort of parachute out of his blanket and just jumping off basically the roof. And Hobbs, who's little voice of sanity there before he actually does this, he says, you know, did you ask your mum if you could jump off the roof? He said, questions I know the answer to, I don't need to ask, right? So he decides, you know, his mum's going to be really stick in the mud, not let him jump off the roof with a blanket. So he does it, and the last line is basically, his mum's going to have a fit about those rose bushes he's fallen into. You know, it's just brilliant. Crunch. I love a crunch in a book.
Yeah.
Crunch.
Yeah, Calvin does throw himself off a lot of things. Obviously, we talked about the hills with the little red truck. We talked about the slow when it's snowing and he's doing it with the sledge.
Got a lot of gumption, that kid.
And there's great panels of him and Hobbs when they hit the bottom, where they're just like flying through the air. And what's interesting as well is that, I don't know if you noticed this, Bill Waterston, when he's doing those hurtling down the hill, is when Calvin and Hobbes have some of their most philosophical conversations about life or about the environment. And then
time,
it's always...
Time as well. Time,
yes.
As well, we talk about. It's the linear passage of time. Why are the good times gone so quickly, you know? Well, that was a quick ride.
Yeah. it's amazing stuff. Now, I'll jump ahead slightly our notes, because when we talk about the writing and the scenarios, one of the things that Calvin has is a variety of alternate personas, alter egos. Tell us about some of them, and in particular, which are your favourites?
Oh, I do like Spaceman Spiff. I think one of my... Spaceman Spiff is... He's absolutely brilliant, because he's just taken himself out and put him into that B science fiction genre, which we've been known to dwell in, and just have his little red spaceship again. I suppose that's just his truck reimagined. But his little red spaceship that's about one person size, totally 50s type little spaceship with a little engine and three wheels with a frap ray. And he's just, his mind's just gone. He doesn't, most of the time, doesn't have Hobbs with him on these adventures. He's just out there trying to find strangeness in strange new worlds. And a lot of the time he's sort of standing on his parents' bed, or he's just looking out the window, just waiting for something to happen. There's a great strip, I'm not sure if he's in this one or not, where he lands on a planet and looking for weirdness, and there's absolutely nothing. The planet is bare. He just sits there, throws the odd stone. A bit bored, really. And has to come back and run around with Hobbs for a little bit to make their own weirdness.
I think Spaceman Spiff is everybody's favourite, really, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so, because it's just so out, you know, and some of the nice drawings, if in the colour ones, that they look fantastic. He's got a Martian landscape and you know, a beautiful views of an alien landscape. They always come across really, really nicely. In this, he's... He does love his little spaceship, and I'm sure in a way that is part of his little red truck as well. It's his imagination turning that into another vehicle in his head.
There's a great Spaceman Spiff on page 96 of the first collection. You mentioned the coloured Sundays. Let's just say that this is in black and white. But and obviously, usually it was a four-panel strip for a newspaper.
Yeah.
But of course, they then started running Calvin and Hobbes in the Sunday, what the Americans would call the funnies.
Yeah.
And those were coloured, particularly later on. And they become... I mean, you know, we sometimes talk about this, Lee, when it's not fair, when these artists can draw, but they can also paint beautifully as well.
Yeah,
the colours on some of the Sunday pages, the landscapes, the great outdoors, but also Spaceman Spiff's alien planets, they're just absolutely gorgeous, aren't they?
They are fantastic. And they're alien. They're very alien. You know, me and you both read a lot of science fiction. We, you know, we look at lots of 2000 AD comics and the like, and we see alien planets and different worlds, but these are alien as anything you've seen, you know, two suns maybe, lightning coming off, strange gases from the planet, things like that. And it just gives that, and as he always calls it, weirdness. I like the idea of weirdness. It's quite a nice word to use when you go somewhere that you've never been before, because it's obviously normal to the planet, but it's weird to you. Calvin, as Spaceman Smith, he blasts into the fifth dimension here, and you can see him zigzagging in this tiny little craft. And he's flying through, you know, you've got a planet there that looks similar to Saturn on its side. You know, it's a sort of a different world, and a slingshot, so the standard slingshot through time warp. His imagination is phenomenal. He will always grow up to be a writer. He'll always grow up to be a thinker outside the box. He's never going to be just that naughty little six-year-old forever, is he?
No, absolutely. So his art style. Now, we mentioned that he does, you know, he does evolve. There is a certain sort of rough and readiness to some of the early Calvins, and then later on he seems to just, like, nail it. His art style develops slightly. What do you make of his sort of, like, his line work and his drawings, particularly in this first collection?
Well, as he does everything, you know, it's very legible. It's very interesting. You actually don't notice it a lot of the time. You're reading. So what you're actually looking at is the picture and the situations. And when they're in the snow, which I really like, because there's no background to a lot of this. In the snow, it's a very simple storyline. He had to get these out quite quickly, I should imagine. And he had sort of deadlines and everything. So it's just, you know, if you've got any snowy bits. So he's got a lot of freedom to use, I think, his line work and his wording. It's just, I think it's good if you don't notice it, and you don't. It doesn't get in the way of any of the action. It doesn't seem to bother, and it flows beautifully. You never get that sense where you've read the wrong thing in the wrong order.
No. I mean, he just, you know, it is beautiful, the line work, the simplicity, but the humour in practically every panel. If you look at what he's doing, he just draws funny. It's great work. Hobbs is a delightful character, particularly when he comes to life. And
he's not a bad-looking little stuffed tiger either, though. You know, you can imagine they would have flown off the shelves if they'd have ever been allowed to get on there.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about merchandising in just a moment. But, yes, he would have been a lovely stuffed toy for a load of kids. Would have loved that.
About Christmas presents for years to come, yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, the Sunday strips, they're interesting, particularly in this early volumes, because different newspapers in America would print different parts of it that Bill Waterson had to be prepared that they would cut off the top row of three rows of panels. Yeah. So he had to have throwaway gags.
Sometimes it goes up.
Yes. You were saying you were watching a documentary about this and how he...
Yes, there is on YouTube. There's a couple of documentaries. Please forgive me, I forget which one it was on there, and I shouldn't advertise YouTube, but he's... they explained that he had to sort of, in the end, sort of push his do-you-know-who-I-am type status, really. You know, we need this. This is not making sense to the reader as much as it should do. I think it was Universal... I think it was. Anyway, they actually said, well, yes, okay, you're allowed to have the format that you would like, so you can get all the story on one page. And I will definitely dig that out before you go to air and send it to you. So you'll have to bear with me on that.
Okay, no worries. We'll put links for it in the show notes for this episode and to some of the Calvin and Hobbes documentaries. So, yes, what happens is, of course, Calvin and Hobbes becomes probably the most successful American newspaper strip since Schultz's Peanuts.
He's one of his heroes as well.
Yes, absolutely. And it is enormously successful. It's enormously, you know, all the newspapers want to print Calvin and Hobbes. And at some point, Waterson manages to renegotiate his deal with the Universal Syndication to say, when they print the Sunday strips, they need to print the whole thing. I think it's because it runs for 10 years from November 85 to December 95. And I think the first 6 years he was constrained by the syndication. But after that, the last 4 years, it's like, no, you've got to print the whole thing. And of course, newspapers wanted Calvin and Hobbes, so they printed the whole thing.
Yeah. Oh, they acquiesced. They needed to, because he knew what he was going to say. You know, how can an editor decide what the artist wants to say before it turns up? And this is how you've got to make it. He knows how he wants his strip to flow. This is how it should be. And because he was really bringing in the bacon at the time and making everything hilarious. Because over this 10 years, there has been very little slip in standard. You know, later on, you had the bubblegum episodes, which may be a bit pushing it a little bit too hard. With the chewing gum ones, do you remember those?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, famous sort of magazines for chewing gum. And, you know, you really take chewing gum seriously. You've got to buy the magazines and... You've got to do exercises and to get your aerobic level up. You've got to wear a watch that measures your chewing stats.
Do you feel that there's a slight criticism of us as collectors in there at all, Lee?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, definitely. I think, he knows that he's got an audience that's going to go along with the joke. We're not going to be alienated by it. I think that's the thing. We've gone this, you know, we've followed him this far. I like his... I like that attitude, and I think that's exactly where he places himself. And the quality was just, you know, for 10 years it was fantastic. Sandra was going in for a minor op in the early 90s, and I went out and bought her a book and just signed it. And before she woke up from an anaesthetic, she had a new Calvin Hobbes book sitting on her bedside, so she realised I'd actually been in while she was asleep. She still got it.
Well, that's something nice to wake up to, isn't it? A new Calvin and Hobbes collection.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's nice to sit in a hospital if you feel a bit sorry for yourself, to cheer yourself up.
To read these, because they are endlessly great to laugh at. They're also philosophical, as we say. There is some great stuff in here about life, about the environment. I mentioned there was the 10 yearly collections. There was also a number of other Treasury editions with... particularly the Sunday strips and things like exhibition catalogues. The 10th anniversary one is a nice one because it contains lots of notes from Bill Waterson himself about some of the strips and how he drew Calvin and Hobbes, how he created the characters, which philosophers inspired him to name them Calvin and Hobbes and so on. So that's great stuff.
Thomas Hobbes, I think he was named after.
That's it, yes. Now, we mentioned that, of course, Bill Waterston becomes quite successful and that he was able to set his own deal with Universal Syndication, and they treated him well. They respected his wishes. We were talking beforehand.
It seemed to, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah. That, you know, they're, in a way, it's a lesson for some, you know, some comic book artists and the way they're treated by their employers.
Definitely, and I suppose it probably was because of his success, and also he seems to be a man who knows his limits. He knows what he wants to do, and he's kept himself in control. I know we'll be getting onto that in a minute, but he keeps in control. So they obviously knew that they're not going to muck this man around too much, you know, because they've got what they're getting out of him at a consistent amount. He's probably, I don't know how much he produced on time. I don't know if they had to chase him or anything like that. That doesn't seem to be written down anywhere. What we do know is he's consistent. He's laying the goose that's got the golden egg. So I think they probably nursed him really well and made sure that they were going to get, you know, because as we know, in the end, he just said, well, that's it. I've done what I can do. I'm going to stop when I'm still happy and healthy.
And he did stop. He retired.
He just said no more. You know.
And we mentioned Schultz and Peanuts. Of course, Peanuts was endlessly merchandised and still is. You can get Peanuts toys. Obviously, there was cartoons, films, bags, everything, lunchboxes. There's a reason why nobody got a Hobbs cuddly toy.
Yeah, also the fact is, and before you say that, Garfield was another successful funny, and everyone had them in their car windows. There was sort of stories at the time of people smashing car windows to get sticky Garfields out. There was Garfield school bags. I think it just blew it up by just being everywhere so quickly, and I think it made it uncool quite quickly, if that's a word.
Yeah,
you know, it just whereas Calvin Hobbes, I just take my hat off to him. I really do. I think it is a very sensible way to do it. It's, you know, keep your love of it without having to sort of over egg it.
So as far as I can tell from reading about him and the documentaries, Bill Waterston's opinion was it's a comic strip. It can be collected into books and treasury editions, but that's it. There will be no other merchandising. It is just a comic strip. Estimates vary, but we're talking possibly hundreds of millions of dollars that he's turned down.
Very much so, you know, and film rights and everything else, I should imagine, would elevate that price as well. You know, there was ideas of making a film of Calvin and Hobbes. There's been a lot of made up versions. If you go into some of the websites, I mean, some great made up versions of sort of Calvin and Hobbes as a sort of, this could be a feature film. We all know that never gets done, but I found at one point, I'm just going back on myself a little bit, apologize. I found at one point when I was a decorator, we were doing a lot of work for lease lets, and between one group of people moving out of a place, we used to go in there and spend a week making sure that it was all nice for the next group of people. As a decorator, you can do that. You've got free reign. You buy the paint and that. And every now and then we sort of had to go up in the loft and clear those out. And we found boxes and boxes of fake Calvin and Hobbes T-shirts that were all meant to be going out to Ibiza. And, you know, there was other ones, Adidas fakes and everything else. But these were just so... There were so many of them, and they were so cheaply made that they just, when they left, they just left them up there. So they were great for me for years for decorating T-shirts.
But none of them officially licensed from Bill Waterston. No,
not one of them, because I was desperate. Because I also, my niece, who's my goddaughter, believe it or not, who is getting married this year, Lauren. She was an absolute fanatical Calvin and Hobbes reader at her young age when she was a little girl, and we just could not get her anything. We thought, oh, go out and get her a toy, go and get her this. And that's when I discovered that he said no to all the merchandising and to the fame afterwards as well. He very rarely does interviews, very rarely.
He is a reclusive character who is more or less retired. He's brought out a couple of other things since 1995, but not much.
No.
He doesn't do interviews. He doesn't do conventions or sign-ins. As we say...
He did do sign-ins once. He did do sign-ins in his little family-owned bookshop.
In
Chagrin Falls, Ohio, near Cleveland. And he used to slip in signed copies of his books into the, you know, just in with all the other copies. You know, there'd be 20 copies of Calvin and Hobbes' Sunday afternoon book or whatever. And he used to sign a couple of them and put them in there. But he stopped doing it when he found out that people were just going in there, picking those ones out and then putting them online and selling them.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And it really goes against what he believed in. So, some rotter has shot it in the foot for some lucky sort of punter who's gone in there, just bought a copy.
Flippers.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, that is a very sad... That's the reason why he's like he is, because he just knows he's so sort of successful that people will just call over other people to get those signed copies.
So he did it for 10 years and then he walked away. He turned down all merchandising apart from the books. Yeah. And his original art, he donated most of the original art to the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library Museum at the Ohio State University. You mentioned Ohio, so it's the Ohio State University. The only original art that's in private hands is a few strips that he gave to his various editors over the years. They have, a couple of them have come up on heritage auctions in the US. And last year, I was looking, so a full colour Sunday strip page went for $480,000. And a black and white single sort of four panel strip went for $237,000.
Wow.
And I think, I'm not entirely sure, but I think we might be in the most expensive Grail page game ever, possibly.
Yeah. It's a bit out of your range, is it, Eamon?
It is, yes, just a touch. I mean, we were talking, because, you know, not long ago we've done Preacher, and there's that issue 3 cover by Glenn Fabry that Jamie chose as his Grail cover, and that came up at Heritage Auctions last year and sold for, I think, $48,000, wow. We since found out. But even, you know, 10 times that for a colour Calvin and Hobbes strip.
That is going to be pride and joy on someone's wall. But I would probably, knowing what he's like, I'd probably feel quite guilty about having that on my wall.
Yes.
It should be in a museum. It should be somewhere where he lives on a wall. And it would probably not sit right with me. All right, yes, I'd love to have the money to be able to buy that, but it probably would not sit right for me to be on my own private collection. But then I'm a little bit...
You'd sort of feel about wanting to gift it to this cartoon library in Ohio, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, you can actually see that cartoon library on earlier when I didn't give you the name of the YouTube program, but you'll actually see it in there. And so they walk around and show you some of the copies of what they've got. It's not a great program, I mark my words. It's like a sort of the whole program's like they're just the end line, you know, like this... this is what he did, this is what he did. But yeah, give it a go anyway. I'll find it for you.
Okay. I will put the link in the show notes. I've also got, there was an exhibition from the, I think from the Cartoon Library, and there's an exhibition catalogue, which I've got, which is rather lovely as well. Calvin and Hobbes Sunday pages, 1985 to 1995. Which is beautiful. There are, as I say, there are the 10 yearly collections. There's a number of treasury editions. They're widely available. You'll find them in your local bookstore. Calvin and Hobbes is still very, very popular and easy to get hold of.
I would really recommend it. They're great books for in the smallest room in the house as well. So you can just thumb through when you're having a relaxing moment.
That's where my kids used to hide them. So they could go and read them on the toilet.
Devious children you've got.
I know.
Calvin.
I know. Well, because when the new book, as I said, when the new book arrived in the house, you know, we probably should have bought 4 copies, but, you know, everybody wanted to read it.
Race to get to the end.
Yeah, exactly. And my kids, I know, used to hide it under the bathroom mat so that when they're in the loo, they could read it. We'll get to the last ever Calvin and Hobbes strip in a moment. But let's go back to the artwork. Like I said, this is going to be a fabulously expensive round of the Grail Page game.
Start saving.
And it is going to be entirely virtual because we would feel slightly guilty about owning the artwork anyway, that we ought to be giving it back to him. But let's say there was some special one-off signed prints or something like that. Have you got a strip or a page from this first collection and then something from the whole run of Calvin and Hobbes that you would choose?
I would. And I did mention it earlier. It is, I do like the, I know the one that me and you would have chosen the same one, but I'm going to let you have that one because I'm sure that the most amazing one is when he's knocking nails into a table. I knew that. Calvin, what are you doing to the coffee table? And there's him with a hammer looking at the nails in the coffee table and says, is this some sort of trick question or what? And that would have been But you give me heads up on what we were going to be talking about today. Thank you very much, Eamon. Very kind of you. But that would have been one of them. But there is one where he's actually my favourite. So once again, the monsters under the bed, and I always come back to this one. And it was that one where Calvin, what's all this noise? You're supposed to be asleep, his dad says, walking in the door. Monsters under the bed, Dad. I was whacking one with my baseball bat. And his dad looks under this. Goodness, Calvin, it's just your stuffed tiger. You should put your toys away. As the dad exits the room, Hobbs obviously comes back to life. And Calvin says to him, sorry, old buddy. Good thing I missed occasionally. Huh? And the tiger then sort of looks at him and says, let me see your bat for a minute, which I just love. I just love that, you know, occasionally missed. He's been whacking him on the head under the bed. It just makes me laugh, and I would like that. I would love that strip, just if I could have it on my wall. That cheers me up every time I see it.
Well, I'll give you that one easily, and I'll also give you the coffee table one as well, because I will probably instead take the toast gag.
Oh, your famous toast gag.
Yes. Yeah, because if I had the 4-panel toast gag on the fridge in our kitchen, we would love that. Although it would have to be.
Also, the fact is, letting a 6-year-old play with a toaster.
Just playing with a toaster, yeah.
Yeah, you know, mum and dad sitting there, you know, has he got a fork out? Is it plugged in? It's these freedoms he was given that I think even as a 70s child, I never got. I wasn't allowed to play with the toaster.
There's a gag in one of the later volumes where Calvin asks his mum where they keep the chainsaws. And she says, we don't have any chainsaws. And Calvin's response is, well, how am I supposed to learn to juggle then? So you have got monsters under the bed. You've got the coffee table gag. I'm going to take the toast gag.
And I've got one more for you.
Yes.
One more. Can I be super greedy? If I was going to have one full picture, and hopefully this isn't bad for everyone just listening, page 36, at the bottom, with Spaceman Spiff climbing out of a once again crashed spaceship, because these spaceships go down on every planet in every book. They smash into it. He's always being attacked. And him coming out there, that is his most heroic Spaceman Spiff look.
It's just wonderful. Spaceman Spiff crash landed on an alien planet. And on the next page, it's our favourite saying, which is Spaceman Spiff is going down, which is also another sort of family saying in our house as well. But yes, I'll give you that as well. You've got some Spaceman Spiff, you've got some monsters under the bed, you've got the gag about the coffee table and the nails.
Thank you so much. You're too generous.
I'm going to give you something in colour as well. I'm going to say that when I might be forcing this one on you. You might not choose it. But I'm going to say that when he does the Sunday strips in colour and when Calvin and Hobbes are in the snow, it's always a good time.
It's lovely, isn't it?
It's always lovely. Tell us about the last ever Calvin and Hobbes strip that appeared.
You might make me cry. You might make me cry. Well, I can't get it word perfect, but what actually happens is he's saying, I didn't get these books in order.
Right.
So I picked them up when I found them. As I say, the early ones I got in the city, the later ones I picked up just shopping occasionally. Unlike you, I didn't go out of my way to get them all the time. I was too busy collecting 2000 AD and the other bits. But what I did do was I found them out of order. So I believe I read that one before I got my last couple of books.
Right.
So I didn't get the goodbye bit quite as much as everyone else who realised he was saying goodbye. So It's a Wonderful World is, old buddy, it is a sign-off from Bill to us. It didn't hit me as hard as it hit everyone else, but it does now. Because they've just got, you know, a new, what's it say? It's a blank piece of paper, which actually is a beautiful, beautiful metaphor for a nice snowy day when no one's been out there before you. We have a lovely hill behind us, Hilly Fields in North London. And if you get there early enough on a snowy day, it does, and it sounds muffled, and like a white piece of paper, which you're going to then go and ride roughshod over and make mushy and slushy. And but at the time, and what he's actually saying is, it's just a wonderful world out there. Try and put your problems behind you, and off we go. And he's done his bit, I think he's saying. This is as far as we go together. Goodbye.
Yeah. December the 31st, 1995. As you said, it snowed, and Hobbs is saying it's like having a big white sheet of paper to draw on. And Calvin says it's a day full of possibilities. It's a magical world, Hobbs' old buddy. Let's go exploring, as they head off down the hill on their sled. Just wonderful. And if you had that in colour, I suspect you'd probably have to pay more than $500,000 for it.
Very much so. I think that's got to be the grail for anyone who goes out there just looking for the best of the best.
It is the best of the best.
Probably someone who doesn't appreciate it as much as someone like us, but they've got a huge bank balance.
Well, I'm hoping that one is in the cartoon library. It better be.
Me too. It would just warm my cockles. And it should be seen by people. It should be seen by lots of people, because it is just, it's a great metaphor for life. It's a great sort of way you should live your life. You know, it's the sort of thing his dad in the cartoons can't do. He's got to go to work. He's got to bring up a young family. He's got to come home from work and find out what Calvin's done wrong that day. You know, he's going to be a tired man. But what they're saying at the end of that is just, come on, enjoy yourself like a six-year-old does. Laugh a lot more, get out there, explore. And don't sort of tie yourself down too much.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Calvin Hobbes is funny. It's inspiring. It's philosophical. It's emotional. It's all these things. It's quite amazing, really, for a simple newspaper strip from America.
Yeah, and also one bit where there's a bit where the construction site comes in and knocks a wood down, and they're going to build a place called Shady Valley. And they said, well, where's all the shade? They said, the only shade there is from the construction truck. You know, it's, you know, all the tree stumps are everywhere, and there's pictures of dancing rabbits. And it is genius from a six-year-old to tell us what we should actually be thinking. And, you know, it's a lovely way to look at life.
Absolutely fantastic. Calvin and Hobbes, in my opinion, the best newspaper strip of all time.
Won't find any argument from me.
No, good. Okay. I was so glad when you picked it. As I say, I nearly bit your hand off when you said suggested it.
You did.
Yes. Obviously, we cannot link it to British comics at all, apart from the fact that it was printed in the Sunday Express, apparently. But
comic.
We'll take it. Easy to find in collections. I particularly recommend the coloured Treasury editions, but any Calvin and Hobbes collection you can find in your local bookshop is going to be worth the money. You'll enjoy it. If you've never come across the wonders of Calvin and Hobbes, dive in.
Honestly, you'll be addicted. You'll probably, if you get the first book or any of the books, you don't need to be in order. I'll be very, very surprised if you didn't buy them all afterwards.
Yeah. Really,
they become infectious.
They're wonderful. And as you say, we have them in the house to hand.
Hidden around.
Yes. Still hidden around in various places, even though the children have grown up and left. But when they come back, they can still pick up a Calvin and Hobbes collection. Great stuff, Lee. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Eamon.
Now, guest projects. Before we get to Lawless, are you still picking up litter on your jogs?
Yeah, well, not so much on my jogs, because I'm normally at home on the treadmill at the moment. Sort of, I'm finding that's a bit better on my knees and the back of my hamstring. So I tend to use a treadmill more than I do going out. But we do a lot of litter picking. We've got an official litter picking group. This area, you know, you can do it one day and then you go back next day and you've got another bag. So, yeah, it's painting a fourth bridge type job. But, yeah, we still do that. It's brilliant. We've got over 4,000 bags in 4 years. So we're really quite happy with our little group, what we do. And and there's also a UK litter picking websites where you can sort of just tell them what you've done and where you... And there's so many of them, man. There's over 100,000 people now doing it around the country. It's fantastic. But as I say, I don't do it so much when I'm running now. I've normally cleaned up the area when I do actually go out for a jog.
Good. Well, we can tie it into the environmentalism of Bill Waterston and Calvin and Hobbes.
Very much so, because there's a couple of ones in his book where he's actually had to pick up a few bits of litter and walk them out. I've got to carry these disgusting things home, you know. Yeah, so what's a famous line he once said? Soon there won't be anywhere nice enough to fight over. That's the only good thing about it.
Yes, you do see Calvin looking out over some rubbish-filled landscapes at times and just sort of like bemoaning humanity with Hobbes.
Which is quite good, yeah, which is Hobbes isn't part of. So he goes, yeah.
Yeah, you guys suck.
Yeah.
And, of course, as we speak, the tickets for Lawless on the 8th and 9th of May in Bristol have gone on sale.
Yeah, go, go, go. It's a great, great event. It's the best. I love the Comic Cons, but I love that one most.
It is the best of them, yes. Yeah, certainly this side of the Irish Sea, it is absolutely the best. We have a great time there every year. We have a great time with all the creators and the events and so on, but we also have a great time, the fan experience, don't we?
Yeah, very much so. And meeting people that you haven't met before, it is friendly. I always say it's friendly. It's a friendly event, and, you know, hopefully we don't leave people sitting on their own. You know, everyone's having a good time. You're not always in each other's pockets, you know. You disappear off, we do different things, and I love it. I love it. I really enjoy it. And Sandra, who's not a 2000 AD fan, my wife, she absolutely loves it as well. She loves coming up there and meeting people and chatting to artists who give so much time, most of them. You feel like you're pals at the end of it, really.
Yeah. Yes, we do have a great time. Sandra has a great time. Sandra is the organiser of the Saturday evening dinner for us, which is...
No pressure this year, then.
No pressure, no. And she is also the official medal awarder of the hot dog run.
Yeah, the official medal awarder, yeah.
She gives out the medals. She does the closing ceremony, as it were, the finish line ceremony of giving out the medals to people or giving out the badges.
Yeah, sitting there on their knees.
So this year will be the fourth official, or should I say probably unofficial, hot dog run on the Saturday morning, 7 o'clock outside the hotel at Lawless.
A way to not feel guilty about having a massive breakfast afterwards.
Exactly. You can go and have a big breakfast. You get a medal, or if you've run it before, you get a badge to add to your medal ribbon. So we've still got some medals and badges to give out this year, which Sandra will be doing for us. Now, in the London Marathon, they have this idea of the, are they called the ever-presents, the people who've run every London Marathon since the beginning?
Oh, right.
And for the hot dog run, there's only the two of us who've done all of them so far. I think it's just you and me.
£1,000, I think.
I think it's just you and me. £1,000 to spend on Calvin and Hobbes. I think it's just you and me. So hopefully we will both complete the fourth one this year.
No doubt. Yeah, I'm very confident that's going to happen.
And sorting out medals for new participants and badges to add to the ribbons for the repeat runners. And
With all these new people listening to the podcast, they'll be coming and joining Lawless and coming for a run with us. So you might need to get quite a few.
Yes, well, come and join us at Lawless. Give us a shout out on the Lawless Facebook group, if people still do Facebook. And come and join us at the hot dog run if you fancy a fairly gentle 3.5 mile run around Bristol Harbour. Starts and finishes at the hotel, like a park run. And we got badges.
and also some people walk it as well.
You can walk it, yeah. Richard Sheaf is our tail walker, and we'll be doing the same again hopefully this year. So, yeah, we're looking forward to it.
Well organised, Damon.
Well, it's you and me between us, I think, and Sandra, I should say. The three of us organise it. It's the three of us. It's Sandra, you and me who organise it, so, yeah.
Fantastic. She'll tell her when she gets in tonight.
She's officially on the committee. She didn't know, but she is, yeah.
Non-paying job.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, exactly. The high-paying job that will not allow you to buy any more Calvin and Hobbes or any more 2000 AD collections, but you probably still will.
Yeah, awesome. Always do. Always say I won't, always will.
Anything else to mention in guest projects, Lee?
Oh, the vineyard, as I mentioned last year.
Oh, yes, of course.
Forty Hill Vineyard. We have still a bunch of volunteers who get together, we have a laugh. We're doing pruning at the moment, which is the hardest job thinking job I have to do. I'm a team leader there, and it's lovely to get outside when the weather's okay. Look after these vines, and we try and make the wines so we can sell to keep the whole project going. There's no profit involved. We just keep the wheels turning and make sure the farm keeps going. So it's fantastic. It's really nice, and we've got a lot of people there that just don't get out during the day. They've lost loved ones, and they really look forward to it. Well, last week we had to be rained off on a Wednesday. You can't prune in the rain. And so many people said they'd just lost their week. You know, it really is such a good day out, you know, for them to get out of the house and to do something which uses their brains and gets the blood pumping.
Very nice. I will put another link to that in the show notes.
Thank you so much.
No, it's good stuff. It's good work. Keep up the plogging, picking up the litter, keep up the hot dog run, and keep up the work on the vineyard.
Thank you so much. It's a dream, you know, when you're out there on a lovely day and you look around and there's nature everywhere and you've got a sheep batting at the back of your leg, you know, you just think, can't get better than that, can it?
It's a magical world, old buddy.
Exactly. You tend to forget the world that you worry about tends to fade away for a little while.
And if we keep it up, we will eventually have enough money to buy a Calvin and Hobbes strip and then give it back to the museum.
Yeah, very much so. It's a bit of a schlep for me to go and visit and have a look every now and then, though. Ohio, Midwest.
Yeah, but quite astonishing that we've got this Grail Page game where we're actually going to, you know, if we had the money, we would buy it and then give it away straight away.
Well, yeah, that's my bad. But this, you know, everyone else, just keep what you've done before. You know, the Glen Fabry from the last one.
Jamie can keep that, but
he might have to let us come around and have a look.
Yeah. Oh no, he absolutely has to let us have a look at it. But yeah, in the spirit of Bill Waterston, if we did ever come across an original, we would give it to the museum. There you go.
Oh, it was in a museum.
Well said, Indy. Great. Thank you very much, Lee. That was perfect.
Thank you so much, Eamon, and thank you everyone out there listening. I hope it was interesting.
Yeah, thank you for listening to Megacity Book Club. We are at megacitybookclub.com. We are on all the socials. We are emailed at mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to come on the book club, or if you want to talk about Calvin and Hobbes, or if you want to join us at the fourth hot dog run, get in touch, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. So until next time, Lee and I are now off to play an intense game of Calvin Ball. And but in the meantime, it is a magical world. And thank you very much, and goodbye from me. And
it's goodbye from me too. Thank you very much, Eamon. Thank you, everyone.